This isn't fly. This is folly.
With style.
How do you know when they're ready?
Well, you never really know, but when they know, you'll know, you know?
How do you know something bad isn't gonna happen?
I know!
Sad, strange little man.
Welcome to the fifth episode of Falling with Style. I'm Doug.
And I'm Derek.
And this is an ongoing Pixar movie marathon podcast. Each episode is dedicated to exactly one movie in the Pixar Animation Studios canon. Today we're talking about Finding Nemo, Pixar's fifth film, the third of the four lunch meeting movies, and the animated film that after nearly a decade dethroned The Lion King as highest grossing animated film of all time. For a little while, before every big movie dethroned every other big movie, pretty much all the time. Finding Nemo is directed by Andrew Stanton, who previously served as a co-director or a co-writer on every Pixar film previous to this one. It was developed and written by a whole bunch of folks, per usual, and it was released widely as Pixar's first summer film on May 30th, 2003, about a year and a half after Monsters, Inc. And prior to this conversation, Doug has seen it maybe half a dozen times, actually. This is the fewest I've seen, one of the ones we've talked about so far. And Derek, you've seen it?
A couple of times. This is one that I actually owned on DVD, but it wasn't one of those like go-to movies that I watched over and over again. But I've seen it more than I'd seen Monsters, Inc. and A Bug's Life, so step up from that.
cool. And we are actually joined by a guest today, which I'm super excited about. One of the things I love about this podcast is that we get to bring on all kinds of different folks and voices and get all sorts of different perspectives on Pixar movies, which I always feel like I know a lot about, and then somebody tells me something new. So we are joined today by Mara from the Toku Ladies podcast. Hello, Mara.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for joining us. I am so curious, just out of the gate. So our podcast here is was born out of the idea that I am a huge Pixar fan and I've seen, you know, most Pixar films a bajillion times and I just have always gravitated towards it. And Derek, not as much. Not to say not a fan, but just sees them when they happen across his path. So if that's the spectrum of like Pixar fandom, like where do you fall on that?
Ooh, I would say early on in Pixar's life, we saw most of them at one point or another. Since having kids, less often. I'm not a gigantic movie fan. Like, a movie has to really call out to me for one reason or another. But we had seen most of the original ones. We're fans of animation. So, you know, good animation would get our attention. And then with the kids, sometimes, but more often I would send the kids off with my husband to go see a movie so that I could get something else done. So, you know, I kind of got out of the habit.
Sure. No, that makes sense. I feel like Pixar, I feel like everybody falls sort of on one of those two wavelengths, right? Like either you go and see every Pixar movie or something speaks to you about one of them. But yeah. I've yet to meet somebody who just like doesn't watch Pixar movies. So
these days, yeah, I haven't seen a movie. I almost never see movies in the movie theater these days. Life just got complicated. But yeah, when I was looking at the early list, I hadn't realized how many of them I had seen.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was like, oh wait, right, of course, because I don't pay that much attention to movies. I hadn't realized. I was like, oh yeah, I've seen that one and that one, and then there's a sudden drop off.
Derek and I were just talking about, because we watch these chronologically, so we're still like in the early sort of nostalgic phase of Pixar, and we were just talking about how we're about to enter into some newer eras of Pixar, and I would not be surprised if one of those two newer eras was where a lot of people started to fall off of the all of them train, you know?
Yeah,
this is definitely the point where I'm not really watching them very often. Like, I'm either not seeing them, or maybe like I'll catch them long after they've come out and it's just like, oh, okay, that was cool, and moving on, which, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just getting older and stuff changing and stuff, and maybe it is the movies. I don't know. I'm curious to see how the movies sort of change as we progress through the whole filmography.
Yeah. Yeah. So this one, like I said, this was directed by Andrew Stanton. The story was also Andrew Stanton's, and he also contributed to the screenplay. So he's not solely responsible for the product that is Finding Nemo, but he's as close as we get until we get one of those auteur directors who's pretty much in charge of everything. He's about as close as you get. The other folks that were involved are involved in the screenplay. So the screenplay was written by, like I said, Andrew Stanton, Bob Peterson, and David Reynolds. We've mentioned Bob Peterson before, but mostly as a voice actor. He's the voice of Roz from Monsters, Inc. Mm. But before he was the voice of Roz, he was working at Pixar. So this makes a little more sense. And as far as the creation of the movie, I mentioned it was one of those lunch meeting movies. So it was one of the movies they sat down during the production of Toy Story and said, we need more. What can we come up with? This was one of those. And this was Andrew Stanton's sort of baby. He talks about how this is something that he had been thinking about and had been brewing in his head since 1995, I think is when he usually says, which makes sense given the release of Toy Story. And then it took this long for him to sort of figure out exactly what he was going to do with it. And he cited numerous sources of inspiration for the movie, which makes sense when you spend years kind of figuring it out. And these are a few of them. He said, you know, simply the challenge of animating the environment. Yeah. He thought it would be a cool thing to do, basically, is to try to make an underwater environment. Given how long it takes them to get to some of these techniques, I'm not surprised this wasn't their first or their second movie. He also said he recognized his own sort of protectiveness in his relationship with his son, and that started to develop where things might go for him. And then ironically, he also cites having seen an early cut of The Lion King that he says he took great issues with. And he said it romanticized the animal kingdom too much, and he wanted to make a movie that didn't do that. He's described himself as cynical on a number of occasions, and I have a quote here that I think helps to elaborate on that. So this is from an Insider article from 2016. So this wasn't necessarily from the release or whatever, but it says Stanton saw an early cut of The Lion King. He had some issues with it. And he says, I remember just slamming on it, Stanton said. Shows what I know. I was a hot-headed piss and vinegar 20-something. I thought, oh, this is sort of whitewashing the whole idea that things actually want to kill everything else.
Right, that they want to eat each other.
Right. And I thought, could you make a movie that's more like Bambi, where you work more with the rules of nature, where everything wants to eat you, like you said, Mara? Nemo is working with the real world, the real predatory world, and was definitely a response to that movie, which is really funny considering that Finding Nemo goes on to be the movie that sort of outdoes The Lion King, which he then goes on to say he was an idiot about criticizing. So it's kind of a beautiful cycle.
I mean, I think it is a fair criticism of The Lion King. And I think that this movie is a better, I mean, obviously it's still an animated, you know, movie with talking fish and, you know, what have you, but it is a little closer to how the ocean actually works. So
yeah.
I mean, I think it's fair.
It's a lot more threatening consistently throughout, which I think is something he set out to do and I think succeeded at.
Definitely.
Like Lion King was trying to be like an operatic thing that was basically, you know, telling a very human story just like with animals in it. And Finding Nemo very clearly is about the fact that they are fish living underwater.
Right.
Like,
yes.
You can't, like, you can obviously translate a lot of the narrative to, like, humanity, but a lot of plot points and characters it only can work if they are underwater and fishes.
Yes.
You can't ignore that oceans have sharks. Even the Little Mermaid had sharks. You know what I mean? So...
But yeah, right. You're right. A lot of the plots simply just cannot translate. Like, you just can't do a lot of the stuff. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it that way.
So when Derek and I were sort of talking about, like, we really want to have guests for these episodes when we can find them, Finding Nemo, for me, was one where I really hoped. You know, I didn't know who we were going to get. I didn't know who was going to reach back out to us or what movies they were going to say that they identified with. But I really hoped that for Finding Nemo, a parent would reach out to us, because neither one of us are parents. And this is very much heavy on the parent story. So I was really thrilled, Mara, when you reached out to us. But you reached out even with a more, I think, specific perspective than just, I'm a parent and I get this. So if you're comfortable, I would love to hear your background with this, because I think it's something people wouldn't necessarily think of when they're watching this movie.
Yep. So the background is, I went to look at the dates because I couldn't remember. So this movie came out, in, as you said, in May 2003. And that actually turns out, once I looked it up, to be the exact month that my husband and I started doing treatments for infertility to try and have a baby. We had been trying to have a kid for, at that point, 2.5 years, I think, unsuccessfully. And we got started with all kinds of medical treatments, and it was very, very unpleasant. I didn't know it in May 2003, but I was over a year away from getting pregnant. But we really wanted a kid, and the feeling of being an overprotective parent rang true to me. That feeling that I'll do anything for my kid. You know, I was going through, you know, needles and all kinds of extremely unpleasant medical procedures that you do not want to know about, believe me, trying to get pregnant. And that really made sense. Also, Marlon's kind of the classic overprotective Jewish parent stereotype also, which works out nicely. So, yeah, I get Marlon. I do. Like, I understand the wanting to hover over your kid and wrap them up in bubble wrap, because I have that feeling all the time with my kids. I'll just close them in their room and then nothing can hurt them.
Yeah.
I get that. Totally do.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, this movie is sort of introduced with the idea that, like, I fought for this kid, and you were fighting for your kid before you even knew how things would turn out. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Do you remember, like, when you saw this movie in that sort of timeline of things?
No, I was trying to figure that out. This is why I ended up going back. I went back to LiveJournal to look at my old posts. That's how much I put effort into this. No,
oh my God. Well, we love that.
Yeah, I could not remember when we saw it. I doubt we saw it when it first came out. Because we're not usually rushed to the movie theater immediately, but it was probably over that summer would be my guess. Mm-hmm. But thanks to all of the medical treatments, I don't remember much about that period. It's literally I was going through the LiveJournal, going, I don't even remember half of this.
Oh, jeez, what a surreal experience.
It was rough. Like, I was reminded of a lot of things that I had forgotten about once I started going back. Yeah, no, I don't remember. Somewhere probably over that summer, but I mean, definitely before I got pregnant.
Is this one that, you know, Derek and I always do our little, like, how many times have you seen this one? Which is funny, because I thought I had seen this one, or I thought I wouldn't remember very much from this one based on how many times I'd seen it. But I felt like I remembered everything very vividly. Is this in your rotation? Is it one that you still feel really close to, or one that you still watch? Or I guess, what's your relationship with it, given all that?
I still feel really close to it. I saw it at least twice. I saw it once after it came out, and then I saw it one other time after that. I don't remember when, maybe with, you know, friends on New Year's Eve or something. I'm not sure how I would feel watching it again. That you know, lost child, especially, yeah. Then after going through all the trouble to get kids, we had all kinds of other problems, and so I get very anxious around things that involve harm to children. So I'm honestly not sure I could watch it again. I actually asked my daughter, we were eating dinner, and I asked her if she'd seen it, and she said yes, probably either in her film class or at camp or something like that. And I was like, you know, how do you feel about it? And she's like, it was okay.
That's especially funny if she did see it in a film class, because I feel like a film class would end up having a lot to say about this one. But
yeah.
I guess when you're in the class, you either end up, like, hyper appreciating something, or sort of just being like, yeah, okay, fine.
I think that's why I'm thinking it was probably in film class, because she gets very, you know, very picky. But it was just really funny because I'm sitting here having all of these emotions about it, and she's like, it was okay. Yep, that is parenting in a nutshell right there. Parent is having emotions, child goes, eh.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of traumatic stuff in this in this movie, right from the get-go. And in a way that, like, I do think it was interesting watching this as an adult now, because I feel like I knew that that happened in my brain from having seen the movie, but it doesn't really register with you when you're a kid just how, like, terrifying and traumatic a lot of this stuff is. And I think, like, most of the stuff that stuck with me from having watched it, you know, being younger, was just, like, all the stuff that kind of gets memed from it or that people were quoting from it, that, like, fish are friends, not food, and, like, he is my squishy. Like, you remember that stuff. And then, you know, watching it now, this is really intense and... more so than any other Pixar movie up to this point that we've watched, it feels like this was a movie that was a lot more overtly aimed towards adults narratively, and then they just threw a lot of jokes and fun kid stuff for kids to also enjoy and a lot of pretty colors to enjoy. But, like, the narrative is for adults.
It really is. Yeah, and of course, I saw it as an adult, so I, you know.
Right.
I'm trying to think. Wait, 2003, so I was over 30. I was like 32, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I definitely saw it as an adult. But, yeah, I actually hadn't thought about that. I know my son hasn't seen, at least I'm pretty sure he hasn't seen it. Or if he has seen it, he won't remember. But I don't know if I would watch it with him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I feel like, you know, I don't know specifically. Obviously, I only know the conversations that parents have about this. But there's, you know, an author that both Derek and I admire named Chuck Wendig, who talks about this, and he talked about it specifically with Pixar because of Toy Story 3, and he was just sort of musing one day on Twitter about, like, I'm not really sure what to do with Toy Story 3, because it's appropriate for an entire family because it is a Pixar movie, but it's also really scary in a lot of ways, and I'm just not sure how to decide when a kid is ready for that.
Yeah, it's hard.
And I think Lion King probably had a little bit of that too. I think this probably has it more than that, and Toy Story 3 probably has it even a little bit more than that.
I mean I've definitely had this. It varies a lot by kid. My daughter is just generally a more mature person, making sure my son's not around to hear me say that. You know, so I was more comfortable with her seeing things earlier. My son is more like me, you know, anxiety disorder and anxious about things in general, and so I've been a lot pickier about what I let him watch. You know, just over on the Toku side, he got me into watching Power Rangers, which is how all of that got started.
I didn't realize that.
He was in preschool, and one of the other kids was watching the airing Power Rangers series, which was Samurai. And,
oh, this sounds familiar.
Yeah, you've probably heard, like, from Bats. So our friend Second Batgirl was a big Power Rangers fan, and I said, oh, well, let's try it. So I sat down with him and watched it, and we got into it, and then he started watching other seasons. So I was looking at, you know, the plots of the other seasons, trying to decide what I was comfortable, you know, whether we wanted to watch it. And I got to the season Power Rangers RPM, which is essentially a post destruction of the world, you know, dystopia. And my son was probably, he was less than five. And and I was like, I don't think I'm comfortable with him watching that. And he got really irritated with me. And so, like, he would like every month be like, can I watch it now? No. Can I watch it now? No. Because kids are like that. I let him watch it probably a year or two later, and it was fine. But, most of the other seasons, I'd been like, all right, you know, cartoony violence, whatever. But I was not sure either he or I was up to a you know, dystopian end of the world. You know, most of humanity is destroyed.
Yeah. I imagine that in those circumstances, you have to evaluate if, like, you're ready for that, too. Like, not even just as an individual, but for whatever conversations might happen.
Yep.
That makes sense.
And so it ends up being like an evaluation of the two of you together in response to whatever this thing might be.
Yeah. So I don't know if I would watch this movie with him. I'm not sure I would be ready for that conversation. He and I are both pretty clingy, so.
Sure.
Well, and there's such a difference between scary stuff as in just like scary visuals, which a lot of kids movies have, and, like, you know, you just you know, that's just kind of part and parcel for it, and I'm sure the kids like being scared by that kind of stuff sometimes too, but there's a difference between that and, like, this sort of like kind of existential horror that like digs into your brain. Like, what if my parents died or something like that? Like that, or what if I got lost? Or, or you know, those types of things are, or, you know, what if the world ended? Like, when you're talking about Power Rangers RPM, like, these are these bigger, scary things that, like, it's not like you see one scary thing on screen and then you don't see it anymore. Like, that's a thing you're going to be thinking about for a long time afterwards. And that's a harder conversation to have. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's something that I would have had a nightmare after watching as a kid. Now, I will grant you, my son is now much older and I'm sure it would be just fine. I mean, he's 11. I'm sure it would be fine. But I'm not sure I could handle watching it with him. He would be okay. He can handle it now, but I don't think I can.
Well, because I think the conversations that come up end up being tough. Like, so one of the reasons Derek and I are doing this is because we're trying to track sort of a few things with Pixar. I mean, I particularly am interested in seeing the evolution of the sort of technical side of the animation. But we're also tracking storytelling and how does that evolve, and a little bit of branding, like who is Pixar, you know what I mean, 20 some years into their thing. And one thing that makes doing this interesting is finding those things that are like particularly adult or existential fears. You know, we sort of pinned the Toy Story movies we've seen so far as very full of anxiety, and this sort of anxiety about existence and anxiety about belonging and being loved.
Monsters Inc. is entirely about that. Like, it is specifically about that. That is the plot.
Yeah, it's got a lot of just fear in it, right? And like, and unexpected fear and expected fear. And what do you do with that? And am I scary? Are they scary? Like, what is scary? You know?
I don't think either. I don't know. Again, my daughter, because she's done a bunch of film classes, she's seen more than I know. I don't think my son has seen most of these. Now I'm going to have to ask him, because now I'm curious. But yeah, they're very existentially fearful.
I do think A Bug's Life is the least existential of them, but it does deal with like oppression and like social structures that keep you down. You know what I mean? So it's funny looking back at them and being like, they're the types of things these movies do that sort of manipulate your emotions at a surface level, so you know you're supposed to be scared. But then what they're doing beyond that about why you are actually scared, beyond just the tone or just the sort of ultimate vibe or music or what you're seeing with your eyeballs, is it's really fascinating to track. And this one, I don't even think, having seen it, I don't even think I was really – I don't think I'd ever looked at this movie as one about trauma.
Whereas I obviously had.
Well, yeah. I think to say that, like, I recognize there was trauma in this movie, but I think if I hadn't rewatched it in this particular way, I think I would have said, like, yeah, that movie starts with trauma.
Right.
But I don't think it just starts with trauma. I think this movie is largely about, and I was surprised to not see this come up in the interviews I was reading or much of the material I was kind of going through. I feel like this movie is very much one about how different people sort of weigh out or cope with their trauma, how they react to other people's trauma, and how those things sort of interact with one another, and how that sort of affects relationships based on all the different individuals involved and all their different kinds of trauma. Because there's like single incident trauma, there's like ongoing trauma, there's complex trauma, and each character is going through something, and they're all kind of figuring out how to tackle their stuff while also trying to understand other people's trauma. And I just was like, I just was kind of blown away because I'd never looked at it beyond that first sort of like movie inciting, right? Like trauma, the one that like kicks it off.
Yeah. I mean, Marlin, as I said, Marlin is me. You find as a parent, there are things that you will do that you did not expect. Everything from I discovered as a parent that you learn how to catch your child's vomit in your hands because it is easier than cleaning it up off the floor. That is a thing that it turns out. And if you had asked me before I had a kid, I would have said, not on your life, not a chance, never.
That makes total sense. A lot less carpet scrubbing.
Yep. Then my yeah. son threw up every night for a year. So, you know, you learn how to do that. But I mean, just, yeah, that and I am not a naturally confrontational in real life person, but I've discovered when it's your kid, you know, pestered my son's doctor until he got the surgery that he needed because, gosh darn it, he needed it and it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Would I have done that for myself? Probably not.
Well, I get why Marlon resonates with you because that's mm-hmm. exactly what he's doing in this movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't fight for himself.
Absolutely not.
Until he has to do it to fight for his son.
Yep.
And it's a literal journey for him to get to the point where he's like, fuck it, I'm fighting for this kid no matter what happens.
Yeah, and he's afraid the whole time. Yeah. But that doesn't matter because his kid needs him. And I get that so much. But I one of the things I like actually as I was sort of, you know, skimming through bits, I had forgotten that both Marlon's movie and Nemo's movie, and that they mm-hmm. neither one saves the other one. They both save themselves and come back together, which is something that I think is a really nice... I mean, not that I have anything against, you know, somebody saving somebody else. Obviously, I watch Power Rangers. I'm all about heroes and superheroes. But it's a really nice thing that they both have their own journey. They both learn how to save themselves, and then they find each other and save themselves together. And that's just really a nice message, I think.
It's really profound because it sort of happens as a result of them getting close to one another and then the movie sort of breaking your heart a little bit because they're so close and it doesn't happen. And you're like, no, that was supposed to happen. So you're like kind of rooting for things to go right. But because they go wrong, what you're talking about happens mm-hmm. instead. Marlon has kind of saved himself. Nemo saves himself. And they just sort of find each other stronger as individuals, but together.
Yeah. Like, I took it as sort of like the reason that you want your kid to be able to be independent at a certain point in their life, because then they can have those experiences and they become a better person because of that. And you as a parent are still your own person separate from your kid. And by being able to be separate and going on your own journeys, like, that's only going to bring you closer together ultimately in the end. You know, because it's the polar opposite of them just sitting inside of the sea anemone and never leaving, like, ever, you know.
Yep. And so no matter how tempting it is, you gotta push your kid out and make them do things, and you have to make yourself let go. And it's an interesting thing between my own parenting and, you know, friends who are parents, and my sister has a daughter, and the spectrum from helicopter parent to completely neglectful parent. And it's like there is a happy medium in there, which I hope that I've found. I guess we'll find out as my kids age. But, you know, the parents who just ignore their kids, that's not great. But the helicopter parents are not super great because, you know, the number of kids I know who can't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My brothers-in-law will never be listening, so I will say I have a niece especially, but a couple of nieces and nephews where it's like, you know, you got to let your kid fail occasionally.
Yeah.
You know, you got to just let him go out and mess up and figure out how to fix it. And, you know.
Yeah, and be there when they do, you know, like, and that's okay. Like,
I feel so thankful that, like, my parents trusted me, like, when I was younger. Like, they knew that I, like, they taught me as much as they could and knew that I was smart enough, you know, as I got older and older to, like, you know, if he wants to watch that, he can watch it. If he wants to do that, he can do it. And we trust that he will make the right decisions. And if he doesn't, he will tell us and we'll help him fix it.
Yep.
You know, I think that's like, that's what you got to do.
Yeah. And that's, again, what I'm trying. I always say to my kids, all right, you got to, you know, go deal with this. Let me know if you need help. That's kind of my mantra is let me know if you need help. If you need me to help you talk to the teacher, if you need me to help you write the letter to someone, you know, I am here and I'm happy to help you. But you should try and figure this out for yourself first. And they're mostly doing pretty well. You know, my daughter, when she started middle school, she'd always kind of cruised through classes. So it wasn't, you know, she wasn't really thinking of school as being something difficult. And then she got to her first test in math. And I don't even know what grade she got, but I guess she failed it. And the way the school set up, like, I was notified that she had failed this. And I was like, all right, let's see what happens. And I waited a couple days and nothing happened. And I was like, so, this grade in math, how's that going? And she's like, And I'm like, well, I was like, did you try talking to the teacher? No. Well, maybe you should try that. And she talked to the teacher, but she's a super independent kid now, which is really nice. So yeah, you gotta kind of kick him and go talk to your teacher and let me know if you need me to back you up. But you've got this.
Yeah.
It's hard,
yeah.
Though. It's really hard.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I can only imagine, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly like the journey in this movie. It's just sort of like, it's a leap of faith at a certain point as a parent. And then, you know, you get to see the positive results of it is that Nemo does, you know, pretty courageous things.
He
and like
does.
You said, ends up being able to save himself, you know?
It's so wonderful. Yeah.
And one thing that's cool about this is, you know, because you pointed out, like, they're on their separate journeys. Obviously, each character is supported by and surrounded by different characters in their own journey. And in Marlin's case, it's like one constant, and then he runs into a bunch of characters along the way, and sort of like that epic sort of one challenge after the other as I'm on my quest type of thing. But with Nemo, because he's sort of in one place, he's got this whole cast of characters. And it's interesting to see what character each one of Marlin and Nemo is sort of paired up with, because the more recognizable or the more talked about one, the one that got their own sequel, is Dory. Mm-hmm. But then you also have Gil, who is the sort of hardened aquarium fish, voiced by Willem Dafoe.
Yes.
Amazing. Who Amazing.
Nemo, yeah, I know, right? He's really great. But who Nemo finds like this kinship with for very quick, immediate reasons, because he has a fin that is scarred. He has, you know, tried to do things on his own, and he believes in Nemo immediately. And so it's interesting to see sort of like what each character is sort of, or what the movie sort of communicates to us each character needs based on the character that they end up with. I don't want to say gravitate toward, because Marlin clearly doesn't gravitate toward Dory. but the one that they're paired up with, I think it really informs what those characters need.
Yeah, it makes sense. Because Dory's whole shtick is like constantly the kind of no worries, being kind of carefree and even kind of impulsive and by proxy, like courageous is the kind of thing. He has to not overthink things all the time and just do something.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, even if Dory's kind of like courageous and brave by accident sometimes just from like being naive, but it still is what he needed. It works.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it definitely changes his perspective. Dory's such an interesting character. And, you know, like it's having these conversations now with Finding Dory, the movie already having existed, which I guess I should ask, have either of you seen that one?
Nope.
No, I don't know anything about it.
Okay, so I won't say much about it, but that one specifically exists because Andrew Stanton said, I don't feel like we got enough of Dory in a multidimensional sense, which I think is an interesting thing to know when you're talking about this movie, because I think in this one, she serves a very specific purpose.
Yeah.
Her sort of, if you're looking at this movie through the scope of like everybody is sort of dealing with some sort of personal trauma, hers is sort of implied, perhaps, maybe, but you don't really ever get to know her.
That's
she
true.
Really, for the most part, is there to serve sort of Marlin's journey. And it's for a very, very specific, like razor sharp sort of purpose. Like, keep him light, keep him on his toes, keep him adjusting, you know?
I was thinking when watching it, I was just like, you know, she's as fun as I remember her being, as like a fun comic relief character with like a shtick, but I can't imagine why I don't need to see a sequel centered on her. But now it makes sense saying that, like, that was kind of the point, is that they were like, they recognized that maybe they didn't do service to her as a character.
Right.
I still have no idea how that movie could possibly play out given who the character is, but whatever.
And
we'll see.
I love that.
Yeah, I don't know either. Now I have to Google the movie and
see what that one's all about. Yeah. I think Andrew Stanton was probably either just keenly aware of that, or was sort of gradually haunted is a strong word, but sort of, I feel like maybe he felt like he had unfinished business with Dory that ends up feeling like responsible, right? Like, maybe we could do more with her, and maybe we could give her more than just, isn't it funny that she can't remember anything,
right?
Which I don't think is is meant to be what is funny about her, but it ends up being sort of one and the same because she's sort of the sidekick for this movie.
Right.
Yeah. I get it. I mean, and it's like, I don't particularly love Ellen DeGeneres as a person,
right.
but
right.
she is very talented and she's really good in the role. And like, I could also see it being like, I can see how she could carry a movie playing this particular character in a more multidimensional way. So like, I get it.
Yeah, I feel probably very similarly to you about Ellen DeGeneres. I feel like deserves recognition for a lot of things and just is no longer in the, like, on the same planet as the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when she was extremely relevant. Again, I'm older than y'all, and I remember when she, you know, she did do some important and very relevant things.
Totally.
And then she probably should have shut up.
Yep. As many people should at many times in their lives.
Problem that a lot of people have is that, you know, you, at some point you need to shut up. But yeah, I thought she was great in this. Yeah, she is definitely talented.
And one of those contributions, honestly, is this movie as it is. Because the character of Dory, as we got it, was built around the realization that Ellen DeGeneres would be perfect for what Andrew Stanton hadn't fully sort of fleshed out. He has this really cool quote about, like, let me see if I actually grabbed it because I thought it was really funny. Yeah, so he says, this is about Dory, and it's specifically about how Dory was initially conceived as a male character, which when I first learned, I was like, of course Dory was originally conceived as a male character. This is Pixar's fifth movie. All characters are boys.
You know? Yes, it's the Power Rangers problem.
Exactly. But then I found this quote and I was like, okay, Andrew Stanton, maybe I see you a little bit. Because he says, years back when I was thinking about an angel slash guide fish to help bring the father through this journey, in my stupid single-minded maleness, I thought it would be a guy character. As I was making my notes one night, my wife was watching Ellen's show and I heard her switch subjects five times in one sentence and I went, oh my God, that's it. And then he sort of built the character of Dory, who was probably wasn't even Dory at that point, around that idea. And I guess, you know, fortunately, Ellen DeGeneres was like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, it was it's funny. It was like it's the perfect timing, too, because I know he was probably referring to like the sitcom from the 90s. But like this is right, I think, when she kind of rose back to prominence again, because this is like I think this comes out the same year that her talk show did, which I watched,
which is so wild to think about.
Watched every episode of for like the first couple of years, but like, and then she was kind of like back in the mainstream again for a long time after that.
And everybody knew Dory was her. I mean, it's a, I think it's a huge deal for an out lesbian to be the co-star of this movie. So again, one of the things
that was definitely something that people we're talking about, like, that was an important thing. Absolutely So, you know, there was definitely a point where she should have stopped, but I remember when she came out and that it's hard to believe looking back how much of a big deal that was. Like, it's ridiculous now. It's like, okay, she's a lesbian.
Well, and the amount of hate that she and like Laura Dern just by like proxy ended up getting for a long time afterwards.
Yeah, it was quite a thing. It was quite a time.
That was like a few years into the 90s, right? Around like somewhere between like 93, 95.
I think so.
My little unknowing gay brain remembers that that happened. Like, it's a thing I've always been aware of, even though I had no idea what was going on. And no idea, like, what the significance was. It's just a thing I've always known is that, Ellen came out and people were mad at her.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So if it was mid-90s, then it was around the time I got married, but I had realized that I was bisexual probably probably 6 years before that. It wasn't, probably around 6 years before that. So I, you know.
Gotcha.
Because, of course, when you're bi, it's much easier to go, oh, well, I'm attracted to the opposite sex, so therefore, I am straight. Oh.
Yeah.
Turns out it doesn't actually work that way, but, you know.
What?
Who knew? I got to college and then was like, oh, wait, I didn't know that was a thing.
That pesky college.
College will do
that. Always does it.
College will do that. But, yeah, then I had a crush on a professor, and then
we all?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Come on. She was awesome. She was an archaeologist, and she had the job that I wanted, and she was cool. cool, and yeah.
I love that.
So yeah, so it probably would have been, yeah, it was around the time I got married that Ellen came out, but yeah, it was a huge, huge thing, and I just remember going, come on, people, get a clue.
Well, since we mentioned Ellen DeGeneres and we mentioned Willem Dafoe, I think it's worth mentioning some of the other folks that that contribute to this. We haven't really called out any cast members yet. So Marlin is voiced by Albert Brooks.
Mm-hmm. Love him.
Who I think does such a good job. I didn't really know him before this movie and know him now, obviously. But
yeah,
I love his voice.
Oh, yeah.
It is really pleasant.
He doesn't get many opportunities to do it in this movie, but he's so good at ad-libbing. Like, he's played tons of characters in The Simpsons, like just like random guest characters that never appear again. They always, despite appearing for like one time, are like unforgettable because they just like let him riff, and it's amazing. Oh.
I had no idea. That's awesome.
I did not know that either.
He's the villain in the movie.
I did not know that. He's you know, he's great. Of course, as someone who is Jewish, I always keep track of people who are Jewish. That's why I said Marlin is, Marlin is me. Marlin is my family. That's my people. Those are my relatives. You know, I could hear my grandmother, my grandfather in that. Yeah, it's the classic Jewish parent.
Yeah, he's so fantastic.
He was great.
His wife, Coral, is voiced by Elizabeth Perkins, and Nemo is voiced by Alexander Gould. And really wild fact is that all three of those actors went on to be in Weeds.
Oh,
all
weird.
Of them. All three of them. The whole family.
Wow.
Two of
great.
Which were like regular starring roles. Like, they're part of the main cast. And then Albert Brooks, I believe, played a sort of recurring guest spot.
Okay, I just so discovered that Alexander Gould is also Jewish, which I hadn't known.
Mm-hmm. Which is very cool, because I don't even know if that was a thing they would have like tried to do or if it was a coincidence. Huh. I have no idea.
He was in USY. He went to Nativ. Oh my God. So I'm like, you know, Wikipedia. Wow, he went to Brandeis? Wow, yeah, like serious. Like, yeah, no, I was in USY. I was in USY a lot of years before he was, but cool. I did not know that.
That's so funny. He's really good in this movie, too.
Oh, yes. He is.
Yes.
It's really hard to get a kid character who sounds like a kid and who talks authentically like a kid, which he does, mm-hmm. but also like playing the emotional beats really well. And it's like, it's across the board, just a great performance.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was really wondering if Nemo was voiced by a child. I would have expected Pixar nowadays to do that. I just wasn't sure what to expect of Pixar in the early 2000s. Like, I wasn't sure if I should have expected a kid or if I should have expected like an adult woman. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes. Hard to say with him. But yeah, no, he was great.
Yeah, he's really fantastic. I have to call out, obviously, that John Ratzenberger makes 5 out of 5 in this one. He's the school of moonfish. He's fantastic.
I wrote it as he's the school of fish that respects women.
Yeah, I know, right? I forgot that his introduction into the movie is like, hey, buddy, are you bothering? Actually, you know what? It's not even like, buddy, are you bothering her? It's, hey, miss, is he bothering you? Nice. Which is like even better.
That is even better. I did not remember that.
Great.
Yeah, it's great. And then he's he basically, there he like, he interrupts the two of them when they're arguing and then pretty much exclusively speaks to Dory because Marlin's being an asshole.
Nice.
And he's like, well, I'm just going to focus on you then. It's
That's
great.
So awesome.
The way that they animate the school of fish is so good,
God.
Too. Yeah,
it is. Because the group as a whole is constantly in motion.
Oh, right.
But if you look at the individual fish, they all have the same facial expression all the time. Like the facial, the faces move, but all of them share an emotion simultaneously. So it has this really sort of cool school-like, I guess, effect that is so hard to capture. But I mean, they had an entire team of people that were just literally like, I can't remember what they call it, the schooling and flocking group. Like an entire, it was a small group of animators whose entire job was to focus on the schooling and flocking, which was so, so cool and funny to think about.
It shows.
I believe it.
It shows. The movie is gorgeous.
Oh,
it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, I forgot to mention that one of the other reasons that I knew we had seen this movie and it was meaningful, is that my husband's last name is Fishman.
Oh.
And he has had fish in, you know, in his home since long before he met me. Our very first fish was a betta named Escher. We've pretty much always had fish. I think there was like a year where we didn't, but we've pretty much always had fish. We don't do saltwater fish because there are, first of all, it's much more complicated and it's much more expensive.
I was going to say, it's hard, isn't it?
It's very hard. It's very expensive. And you get into some ecological problems of where the fish are coming from.
Oh.
So
I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I remembered about this movie, I went to look it up because I vaguely remembered this. One of the things about this movie was that while it was trying to convince people not to keep fish in tanks, in a sense, it actually hugely increased the number of people who wanted clownfish, which then caused a run on clownfish and, you know, caused some ecological damage. So, you know, we don't keep clown, we don't keep saltwater fish, we only do freshwater, and we don't buy cichlids, which are a kind of fish that they all come from this one lake in Africa. And so it's, you know, ecologically problematic. The fish that we buy are fish that are bred to be in an aquarium. They're easy to breed. In fact, we often have baby fish in our tanks, which is super fun. I love baby fish. Having baby fish in the tank is the best. They start out with two eyeballs and a tail. And you're looking and suddenly you see two little eyeballs dart across the tank and you're like, hey, there are babies.
It's like that one teeny tiny fish that ran away from the shark meeting. Literally just eyes and a tail.
Yeah, that is absolutely what baby fish look like.
Funny.
They look like two eyes and a tail. And
that is so funny.
So but we very specifically, you know, keep the fish that can just be, you know, bred to be in a tank and are not being pulled out of the environment. So, you know, the irony is that this movie actually caused some ecological damage because, you know, humans suck, basically, is where it takes us.
Yeah, unfortunately, now that I'm thinking about it, like, it unfortunately is, like, almost too logical, right? Like, movie comes out, everybody wants those fish.
Yep.
And I actually, now that I think about it, like, I've seen tanks with clownfish and tangs in them, like,
clearly
for this reason.
Yeah,
like the hospital near me has like a whole tank with clownfish and blue tang, almost certainly because kids are there, and it probably calms them in the short term. Like, I get it, it's delightful, but when everybody's doing that, that's not good.
Yep, it's problematic.
Ugh. Hate that.
human beings are not great.
Yeah.
Well, human beings are all bad guys in this movie, so that's cool.
I mean,
I'm into
that. Right. You can't argue with that.
Actually, you know what, though? I didn't really think about this until now. This Monsters, Inc. was the first movie to sort of have a fully animated, constantly on screen, or almost constantly on screen, like, human figure in Boo. They did cover her up a lot. But this movie, even though they're not on screen a lot, like, the jump from Boo to the people in the dentist's office is like pretty incredible, I think.
I think so too. I would say, honestly, this movie as a whole, of the five movies that we've watched so far, I feel like just animation-wise, it's the biggest jump from one movie to the next.
Yeah.
Like, this movie is like night and day from Monsters, Inc. Like, it's wild, like everything about it. Characters, the settings, the lighting is amazing. Like, I don't know what, I know like early in Pixar, like every movie kind of had their one thing that they were trying to like get better at, like Monsters, Inc. had its fur. I don't really know exactly what it is in this movie because there's a lot of things.
It's water.
I mean, fair. But like I said, like the lighting is so much better than it was in Monsters, Inc. And it's got to be more complicated when you're lighting water, right?
Yes.
You know?
I don't even know how you do that.
Right.
It's a huge jump, but I think one of the reasons it feels like such a huge jump is that it uses all of the things that we've been tracking along the way. Mm-hmm. Like, the way that they use dust in, like, underwater is exactly the way we saw them use dust in Toy Story 2, but better, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The way that they do the anemones literally started with the same technology they used for Sully's fur, but better. You know, so like they took all and the lighting that we sort of talked about with Monsters, Inc., like it's just on another level here. So I think it's just constantly been building to a point where they could make a movie that looks like this. They talked about with A Bug's Life, a lot of the environment that they were able to build underwater in the coral reef specifically came from the foundation they built researching how to build the environment for the bugs.
Oh.
'Cause everything was a bit larger than life and everything was at different angles, and they kind of had to learn how to simplify a complex ecosystem into something that they could build a full set out of. So it's weird because we know that this is nowhere near the last movie they make, but it feels like everything they did to this point built up to this point.
Sure.
And it's just, I think it's a stunning movie. I really think this might be the first Pixar movie that deserves to be called stunning, you know?
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
I think it holds up to today. Like if you said this, like, you know, there are things that they are obviously better at now because it's been 20 years or whatever, but like it holds up extremely well. It doesn't look like a dated movie in the way that the previous Pixar movies did at all. Like the characters are constantly in motion all the time and they're very detailed, and like the backgrounds and the settings that they're in are so good. Like I think that they knew that, because even the end credits are just places that they were, right?
Yes.
But it's just like, they're just so pretty to look at. Like, I think that more than anything, that's like, I knew the narrative of this movie was good and the characters were good, but I think in this viewing of it this time, that's what I was most blown away about, was just how beautiful this movie is.
Yes.
At every second.
Well, you and I are used to watching a movie and being able to instantly identify the things that haven't aged well. I think unless you watched Finding Dory and then watched this, it would be really hard, not impossible, but really hard to point out the things that they probably got better at. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they just use things really well. I mean, they're able to do what they do with water because they're doing water a bunch of different ways and then layering it. They're able to make underwater look the way that it does because they focused on particles, lighting, and coloring, and then they put it all together, you know?
Wow.
So, like, it all looks like one cohesive thing, and you don't think about what they're doing. I mean, you don't think about the fact that things lose their color in the background of this movie, but they do, because that's what happens underwater, you know?
Yeah.
You don't think about, like, how characters have to constantly be in motion until you choose something and you focus on it and you track it, you know? No character is capable in this movie of staying in one place exactly. And they pay attention to that. And they execute that. It's incredible.
I was it really hit me when it was like, there was just one of the points towards the last act in the movie when it's like just Nemo and Dory, and then there's nothing else in the water. I think it's like right before the whale comes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the two of them and just, you know, a blue background, which you'd think would be like, you know, just really basic, because it's like, well, it's two fishes that you've seen before in water, but there's so much detail in just them being in water with nothing else around them. Like the particles and the flecks around there, the way that the lighting changes depending on, like, you know, farther up toward the surface versus farther in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the fact that they are constantly moving and body parts on them are constantly moving. Their gills are constantly moving. Like, there's so much happening even when there's nothing happening. Like, it's just wild.
Yeah. And I mean, as I said, we've kept fish for years and years, and we, you know, had fish for years when this movie came out. We also visited a lot of different aquaria and have spent a lot of time looking at, you know, very large tanks. There's I assume it's still there, the Scripps Oceanographic Institute in San Diego has this amazing tank that essentially it is open to the ocean. And you come inside and there's just one wall of glass that lets you look out. It's not the open ocean, obviously, because you're
sure,
you know, but it's like the tidal pool, you know, and there's just all the stuff that's naturally growing and the fish that come in and go out. And so, like, we've spent a lot of time looking at things like that. And this movie is just gorgeous. It is beautiful. There's nothing about it that screams, you know, this is an animated ocean. It feels really real.
Yeah.
I think it's the first environment they do that you have to look at a second time to realize it isn't real in certain shots.
Or like
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when they do a shot that's zoomed out, it looks
the jellyfish.
Like, yep.
You could just assume that was just live footage.
Oh my God.
Can I geek about the jellyfish for a second?
Yes.
Okay, I'm a massive Survivor fan, and there's a season that they filmed in a place called Palau in the Pacific Ocean. It's part of Micronesia, and there is a lake in Palau on top of a mountain And the only thing that exists in that lake, the only thing that lives there are jellyfish and like microscopic organisms. So these jellyfish have lost their for the most part, their ability to sting. So it's like a lake full of jellyfish that is safe to swim in. And whether it's right or wrong to swim in it, people do it. And it's like a thing. And when I saw that as a kid on Survivor, I was like, that's all I want to do in my whole life is I want to swim in that lake. And then I found out that they went to that lake to study jellyfish to make scene. I was like, no freaking way, like full circle. And I was geeking out so hard about that, because you're right, Derek. I mean, that could have just been filmed. It's incredible.
Yeah, it absolutely could have. They could have been at the, you know, Monterey Aquarium. Monterey Aquarium has a gorgeous jelly exhibit, at least they did 20 years ago when I was there. I'm sure they still do. And yeah, the jellyfish were very realistic.
I feel like they got to be there. I feel like jellies are crowd pleasers.
I have a feeling it's probably still there. Now, jellyfish are actually also very hard to keep in captivity. I think when we were there, it was a big thing because the various aquariums were just figuring out how to keep jellyfish alive. Mm-hmm. You have to do some very specific things with the water, and the water has to cycle in a specific way. I know the Baltimore Aquarium had some problems with it too. That's, you know, again, this is 20 years ago, but I remember it being a really huge deal. Jellyfish are so cool.
I believe it though, because my sister, I don't know what inspired her to do this, but at one point she bought like a jellyfish tank and didn't actually use it. Like, she didn't have any jellyfish and just decided, like, you know what? Doug likes jellyfish and he'll probably use this. So she gave me the tank. And I was like, okay. And then was like, I don't think I'm going to use this, but I guess I should look into it. And I looked into it and I was like, this seems impossible. Yeah. Like, there is no way. Because, yeah, like you said, it has the tank I had was basically like a very wide, flat cylinder on its side.
Yes.
So that the water could move in a certain way and that there were no corners. Mm-hmm. Because if a jellyfish gets stuck in a corner, it's just fucked.
They're just stuck.
Yeah.
They just sit there.
And the way you have to feed it and the type of lighting it can and can't be in and temperature. I was just like, this is a lot. So needless to say, I have not gotten a jellyfish and never will. Like them too much to do that.
This
to
is
one
why
of them.
We keep, you know, we keep little brick red swords or just little, you know, little fish that cost like a couple bucks, and they can live in just about any water, and they handle neglect really well.
Those are the fish that I vibe most with.
Yeah, that we have always had fish that don't require a lot of maintenance, because which is why when we brought home our daughter, we were like, wait, who thought it was a good idea to let us take care of an entire living being? Like human, like, we can barely keep fish alive. What were we thinking? Somehow they both have lived. I don't know how, pure luck.
Of course they are.
But, you know.
Come
on. Yeah.
Oh, mind if I geek out about a couple other voice credits here? Because I think they're very fun. Yeah. In the movies we've talked about so far, there's always, you know, one or two Pixar folks who just like, were in the office that day and made a funny voice. And so they ended up voicing characters. This movie has a lot of them. So, I guess like maybe like four or five, I think. So Crush, the sea turtle, is voiced by the director of this movie, which is amazing.
That's wild, because he was such popular character with kids at the time. That's wild.
And a focal point. Like, he's not like a one-liner. Like, he's a focal point of, like, marketing and it's a whole scene in that movie.
I would have never guessed. You know, you can tell sometimes when it's like, oh, this isn't like a professional actor. This is clearly someone on the crew. But, I thought that was somebody famous.
Yeah, I would never have guessed.
Yeah. And then his son, Squirt, is voiced by Nicholas Bird, son of Brad Bird, who we will talk about when we talk about some other Pixar movies. So that's pretty cool. And then one that I was really surprised by, in the same way I was surprised by Crush, is that Mr. Ray, the teacher, is voiced by Bob Peterson, who is the voice of Roz. And I was like, Roz, I kind of get, because Roz just does a funny voice, right? And it's so monotone that the direction for that character is like, I would have expected, hey, Bob, just do the funny voice. She's a monotone character anyway, so it works no matter what. She doesn't really emote.
Right.
But Mr. Ray is like very vibrant and is singing and is... has his own sort of like humor about him. So I was like floored about the fact that, you know, this was another one of their animators or their storyboard. I mean, Bob Peterson is a huge deal at Pixar.
So like, yeah.
Multi-talented people.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I admire them so much.
I mean, it's a good, like, I just assumed that was a professional actor. He's like, of like the kind of minor characters, he was kind of my favorite one because he was just so funny and fun, and I loved his little science songs.
He's
his
joyful.
Yeah,
he's great.
Yeah, and he's a bit of a nerd, and I like that.
Yeah.
And then Jacques, the cleaner shrimp. This one I wasn't surprised was voiced by somebody in the office because it's like a silly accent character. But Jacques was voiced by Joe Ranft, who was an animator, story supervisor, the voice of Heimlich and Wheezy, and a official designated Disney legend because Joe Ranft died in like I think 2006 and was a huge deal at Pixar and probably would have gone on, I expect, to have directed Pixar movies at some point. But he just, I don't know if either of you have seen Soul yet, but there's an Easter egg in that movie that references Joel Ranft, and it's one of the times that I like cried in that movie because I was like, oh my gosh, based on like the context and everything. So I was like really delighted to see that he also voiced one of these characters because he's just an incredible dude. But this cast is huge. I mean, there's so many people. I don't know if there's anybody else you want to shout out because the list is like 20 people.
I love Allison Janney. I'm a big fan of Allison Janney, so I'm always
Peach the Starfish.
I am always excited about seeing Allison Janney and things.
She rules. I like her too.
She's great. I like that design too because it's so different than everything else. Like the seagulls are different for the sake of humor.
Yes.
Like they're sort of like the weirdest, least rendered, most poorly animated animal on purpose.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. They are deliberately not realistic.
Yeah.
Which
but then
fun.
Peach isn't unrealistic. She just has a different vibe. Like her face just looks different than everybody else. And it ends up being cute. Mm-hmm. And I really dig it. And the performance is great. She's wonderful.
Yeah, fully agree. Yeah, she's great.
I do like the seagulls too. We still do the mine.
Oh yeah.
Like that.
Me
that's
too.
We do that one. Then the kids just look at us funny, and you know.
My two favorite unimportant quotes from this movie. That's one of them. Just saying mine.
Yes.
And the other is one that I feel like no one ever recognizes when I say it because it's so short. But I am obsessed with the little crabs that are just aggressive for no reason. And I love the one that's like, hey, this is ass. Like, it's just like so unnecessarily aggressive.
Yeah.
I say it to my cat. I say it to anybody who sits where I was sitting. Like, I just, this is ass spot.
It's great.
Like, it's so funny.
Yeah.
Oh, those crabs. There's also the lobsters that have I get why they have Boston accents but also inexplicably have Boston accents.
I mean, explicably and yet inexplicably,
right?
Right.
You gotta have your Boston lobsters. Yep. Very important.
Yeah, it's a big
so
cast.
Many characters.
I actually feel like there are probably characters that some of these folks probably voiced for like one line or two that they aren't even credited
for. Sure.
Like,
I'm sure.
I wouldn't be surprised if that lobster was John Ratzenberger, but I couldn't find anything to say that it was, so I'm not going to make that claim. I feel like it would be far more common knowledge if it were, but it seems like it could have been.
Right. That's so funny.
And we meet so many characters at the point. This is one thing I really love about this movie. It's, you know, Marlin's journey is very sort of epic in the sense that he goes out on a quest and learns about himself and is challenged along the way and nearly dies over and over and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then they do the scene where all the sea creatures are like orally telling his epic story to one another.
Oh,
I think it's such
a
cool little thing. It like becomes its own in real time oral tradition. Like it's very cool. It serves the like a purpose in the story, but it's also just a thing where it's like, oh, that's how stories were told.
Yeah. Like, no, I mean absolutely. It's not like they're writing things down in a book.
Yeah.
You know? This is classic And it's so sweet.
It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is interesting that like this, the movie is, it's, you know, it's like this really emotional, like, story of a parent and like a lost child, but it's also like an epic quest movie, and it's also kind of like a buddy comedy road trip movie.
Yes.
And it's like all of those things, but it doesn't feel like messy or anything. Like it all works together. Yep. It's pretty seamlessly done.
Yeah. No, the writing is great. And yeah, it really is a lot of different things at once, and all of them done well.
Yeah.
Which is kind of impressive. You know, usually you get like, okay, we've got, it's a great buddy movie, but you know, this part, oh, all right, that just sort of went along. But no, all of these parts work perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do wonder and suspect probably that part of it is Pixar. I mean, Pixar isn't at a point yet in its history with Finding Nemo that they can afford a failure.
Mm.
So it's not like they
right.
can afford to do anything. I mean, the studio was still on the line, right? But I do think they had footing and they had reputation and their brand was sort of establishing itself by having four home runs in a row.
Yeah.
That at this point, you're developing different projects and there's probably less of the, we have to all make these movies together all at once,
right.
which is very much how Toy Story, A Bug's Life, and Monsters were made. I mean, Monsters, you know, it's interesting. When we get to, this is going to be years from now, but when we get to Soul, there's going to be a massive discussion to be had again about Monsters, Inc. Because I think when you track where the director of that movie mm-hmm. goes, Pete Docter, you're like, wait, okay, so he's responsible for what I think are some of the best animated movies of all time ever for any studio. And something about Monsters, Inc., though I still think brilliant, doesn't quite fit in there. And I think the only explanation is that Monsters, Inc. was still part of this very early Pixar situation, right? This feels like the first movie to start moving away from
that.
And Pixar always has a collaborative element. I mean, they have entire, you know, story teams that you just go to present to and workshop with and stuff like that. It's not, no one's ever making a movie entirely on their own, but this movie feels like it was Andrew Stanton's to make and Andrew Stanton's to make decisions about. And because he was making it at Pixar, he was taking feedback. He was making adjustments based on how people received it. But ultimately, it was Andrew Stanton's to figure out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know that Toy Story felt that way. It felt like a team figuring it out together.
Yeah, I can sort of. There's definitely like a, not quite like an auteur thing, but it's like a little more in that direction where it is like someone's idea rather than like a group idea that they all kind of
together. Things work better when there is one person who gets to make final decisions. You know, this is in many years of working on various projects. You know, it's good to have a collaborative discussion, but at a certain point, somebody needs to go, okay, we're done having a collaborative discussion now, and here is what we are going to do based on this collaborative discussion. And when you don't have that, you get the old, you know, camel as a horse designed by committee effect. I have many, many work projects that have generated camels rather than horses.
Sure.
For that very reason. So, yeah, you know, you got to have somebody to decide.
Because you need a project to be able to evolve and develop, but you also need somebody to be able to anchor it down to what it's supposed to be and where it was coming from in the first place, you know?
And somebody who's looking at looking at everything from the top.
Yeah,
I literally just had this discussion with a friend who I'm hoping to get to come back to be project manager for a project at the office that we worked at, because my office currently does not have a project manager, really. And that is how we create a lot of camels, because, you know, just to have somebody who is keeping an eye on, okay, that's great that you have this really cool idea, but you need to finish this because we need to move on to this next step. You know, you can play with that forever, but we don't have time for that.
Exactly.
So somebody who's going, okay, so we need these parts to be done because they feed into this, which then feeds into this. And, you know, that's a great idea, but it will screw up this other thing that, you know, somebody needs to be up there keeping an eye on it all. And I would assume that's what he was doing. I don't know, but that would be my guess.
Well, and I think that's, you know, we sort of reference these like mini eras that we kind of go through. I think that's what we're we're going into next, mm-hmm. because the next few films all sort of have more of that, and some of them have as close to an auteur as you can get in a Pixar environment, and the next few are all kind of like that. So I think it gets to a point now in Pixar's history where, like, okay, we've got creators with ideas, and mm-hmm. we're going to let them run with yep. them. We're not going to leave them out in the cold, but we're going to let them run.
Yeah,
that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, and you can kind of, I mean, something like this, and I think a lot of other Pixar movies too, they get to be pretty personal stories, and that makes sense if the person who sort of mm-hmm. conceived the idea or is running the idea is attached to that very yeah. personal story mm-hmm. that's being told.
Yeah, I think this is probably the first Pixar movie that has that sort of like vibe very deeply.
It feels different than what we've seen so far, for sure.
Yeah. I was honestly surprised that Andrew Stanton didn't talk about like his own trauma as being the spark for this movie, because there are other Pixar movies where they're like, well, the inspiration for the conflict in this movie was the conflict in the movie that I experienced in real life. And you're like, oh, okay, you just literally made a movie about the thing you went through.
I mean, cool. Like, I mean,
the best art comes out of is unfortunately trauma, but you can make great art.
But this feels like it would have come from that,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And maybe it did, and he just doesn't share that publicly. I have no idea.
Right, that's always
I was surprised awful. that wasn't the story I was finding.
Yeah, yeah.
It does feel like that, yeah. It really works.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, it exists. You were talking about the thread exists throughout the entire movie, but I feel like as much as people talk about like the prologue to Up being like the most emotional thing ever, I feel like the prologue to Finding Nemo, like, I felt like that hit extremely hard. Like, it's
Finding Nemo did it like years before.
Yeah. And it's very effective. Even if you know everything that happens in the movie afterwards, it still hits really hard and is hard to watch. Probably even harder to watch when you know it's coming. So it's an effective movie from that standpoint for sure.
Again, this is why I'm not sure I could watch it again.
Right, from the first second of the movie, it's traumatic. Like,
I can't imagine. Yeah. I mean, look, I once lost one of my kids for like 15 minutes in a store and I nearly collapsed. Geez. So, you know, that was 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, so it's so funny. Derek, you had kind of mentioned the lost kid thing too, and Mary, you just mentioned it too. I actually think the fact that this movie spends more time with Marlin mm-hmm. makes it less scary to kids, because one of the things that is scary to a kid sort of on an existential level is being a lost kid.
Yep.
That is a thing that I was afraid of, was being a lost kid. So I think if they had spent more time with Nemo and made it more about him being lost, like, I think it would have scared more kids.
Yeah, this way it just scared the parents. But the parents can handle it a little better, I assume.
Yeah. One thing that I, given what we were just talking about, that I suspect maybe you'll find mildly unbelievable, is that Andrew Stanton was really, this is one of the things that he did take feedback on eventually, was like, he was really married to the idea of telling Marlin and Coral's story over the course of the movie via flashbacks that would coincide with events of the present.
Ooh.
And people were like, this is too much.
Yeah.
We don't know enough about Marlin to identify, and it's a lot. It's a lot to handle.
Well, I mean,
and he was really, really married to it and finally was like, everybody's giving me this feedback. No one really understands why they're supposed to identify with Marlin until the climax of the movie. And it's just drawing out trauma.
Yeah.
You know, like,
oh my God, that would have been awful.
No, right.
Wouldn't that have been like kind of painful?
Not only would that make it hard to watch, I also think that like that would make him feel like too much of a jerk protagonist, because
I mean, that was the big thing. And that's the thing Pixar struggled with so much early on, is like, we have these complicated characters, but they're all kind of coming across as jerks.
Yes.
Woody?
Right.
Yes.
Sully at one point was sort of a weird character, not because he was a jerk, but because he was trying to be scary, which was bizarre. So it's totally in line that they have a protagonist that like was rubbing people the wrong way.
Yeah, no, if you don't understand what Marlin has, that Marlin lost his wife, then you don't understand why he's being a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas it makes perfect sense once you know that. You know, he's still being an irritating parent, but he's at least being understandably irritating.
Yeah.
But you know exactly why, and you sort of feel for him, with him, you know, all the above along the way, because you know everything.
And you want him to be better because you understand where he's coming from, and it's sort of like, yes. I want you to be able to heal and become a better person from this. And she does, so it makes it very satisfying.
And he does. It is.
It's so cute that they echo that first day of school scene where instead of Nemo jumping on on Marlin, Marlin's jumping around Nemo.
Yes.
I love that.
It's just, they're so cute.
Yeah,
they are.
And it's, you know, it's nice to have good parents. It's the thing that the kids and I talk about a lot when we're watching Toku, but also when we're watching other things, you know, how many times things have missing parents.
Mm-hmm.
Just like missing in the sense of they've gone missing, and missing in the sense of, do these kids have parents? Like, are there any parents around?
Are parents at all existent in this world?
Or is this universe just high school students? Like, you know, the number of times we're like, do they have parents? Are they abandoned? What is going on? And when
this is a town run entirely by teenagers.
Yes, exactly.
Teen Nation.
There's like a couple of teachers and that's it. But yeah, like, you know, shows or movies with good parents are a nice thing to see.
Yeah.
You know, I also love The Incredibles for that reason. They are also parents that I can feel for. Yeah, it is pretty rare to have parents be there, be a main character, and be a good character.
Yeah.
Parents are usually the antagonist. Well, we need to figure out how to get around the parents. We need to trick the parents. We need to sneak past them, you know, whatever.
Or the parents are the cause of all my problems, and the movie then supports it.
Yes,
you know, like,
exactly. I mean, obviously there are bad parents out there, so I don't say that, you know, that should never happen, but I feel like there's a little bit more of that than there needs to be.
Sure.
Like, I'd like to see more good parents, and that's why I love Marlon so much, because he is me.
He's really great.
Yeah. There's really only, like, out of the whole movie, there's only like two things I think that I didn't like, and they're both extremely minor, which I think speaks to how solid this movie is. Yeah. The one thing is in the aquarium, like, didn't like Mount Wana Hakalugi and the weird like Polynesian riff that they were doing.
Well.
That's a very yikesy. But that's just a product of it being kind of dated. The only other thing I didn't like, and this is not a hill that I'll die on, I think it was just like kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I don't really like how they portrayed or handled like Darla. Like, I get from the fish perspective, that's like a villain is a kid who will just shake you until you die because she doesn't understand. I get that. But it still felt kind of like from the movie's perspective, a little bit mean-spirited when they like play the Psycho, literally the Psycho music, the music from Psycho. And I think there's definitely trying to be like, ooh, she has braces and headgear. Isn't that ugly? Which is really mean, I think, too.
Good point.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm less bothered by her being a terror, but when you bring it up with all the pieces and parts, then it becomes this sort of like problematic combination of things.
That like didn't need to be there. It could have just been any kid who is just, you know,
it would be scary no matter what.
Yeah. And also, like, I think they say that she's 8, but I feel like she acts way younger than 8 in the movie.
Pixar hasn't figured out how old children are yet.
I mean, honestly, no TV has figured it out. No movies have figured it out. The number of things that I watch where I'm like, you just said this child was 11. If that child is older than 6, I will eat my hat. Or, of course, there are the quote-unquote high school students, and you're like,
you're my age.
That guy's like 25. I was just watching a show where the one of the heroes is supposed to be in high school. The actor is 26.
Sure.
And then they bring in the guy who's supposed to be his father, and I'm looking at him and going, are you sure? And the actor is like 29. Are you joking? So literally when the supposed father shows up, honest to God, the character opens the door and I'm like, is this one of their classmates that I just haven't like I'm not great with faces, but I'm not totally face blind. I'm like, I haven't seen this character before. Maybe he was one of the characters from this scene? And then finally I'm like, oh wait, he's supposed to be his father? You're joking. Just you know, so like we Yeah, ages. No wonder nobody can tell how old any kid is, because everybody they see is either too old or too young.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Ridiculous.
I think one thing, I feel like bothered isn't an accurate word. I just think there's a conversation to be had that I don't think has like a strong outcome, because I think that they were slightly aware and not fully aware of what they were doing and of whatnot. But I do think there's a conversation to be had about the way that the aquarium fish are portrayed and whether they are supposed to be funny or not, because it's very obvious that they are meant to be sort of affected by the trauma of being in captivity. Mm. But most of the things that they exhibit as sort of being a result of their trauma are also supposed to be funny. Mm. And I think there's a conversation there. I think that they thought that they were tying that in. I think they were. Saying that they thought they did is making it seem unintentional. I think they were tying that into the message that they were sort of including, in part about captivity, but also about trauma and, you know, people's personal journey and stuff. I just think they ended up conflating that with funny.
Yeah.
And I think they probably know they did that, because, again, I think Andrew Stanton made Finding Dory, which I might eat my words because I haven't seen it in a while, but I think he made it knowing some of that.
Interesting.
And uses Finding Dory to maybe explore some
of that.
That
makes sense.
Conversation worth having. I don't think it's necessarily a reason to dislike those characters, dislike the story, or that it necessarily discounts the point that they're trying to make.
Yeah.
I think it's a common... it's a common problem of how do you depict trauma without just being relentlessly depressing. And this, you know, maybe they just, you know, they went too far, but trying to say, hey, they can still be, I mean, they're good friends, you know, they're friends to Nemo.
Yeah.
They're helpful. They're doing their best.
Oh, they're a family together.
They are. Yeah. They are found family.
They are. Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, they're generally positive. Their relationships with one another are very good. They're all capable.
Yeah.
They work together. So that's why it's like, I think there's a conversation. I just don't think it's necessarily, it's not destroying the movie or its characters.
Right.
But I do think it's the type of thing that, like, I am made more aware of, I think, how that could go wrong or worse. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's always a fine line that you're treading, because I think there is a way to sort of like be able to kind of comedically look at like mental health and trauma, but you have to do it in a very particular way. And it is a fine line, and it's really easy to cross that line into just straight up ableism. And like, this movie isn't terrible with it. Like, it's not mean or anything about it, it is like,
Nothing feels mean.
But it is a thing where it's like, that can be tweaked and tightened and done a little bit better with more knowledge, I think. So,
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's so little to find about this movie to criticize.
Oh,
I think it's
right.
So freaking well executed that, you know, like, if you're doing criticism of it, you're not going to find all that much. Mm-hmm. You either vibe with it or you don't, but it's well done.
I think you're right. I think that's an interesting discussion to have, and to look at how some other movies handle it, and because mental health is not something that's handled particularly well in media in general. Ever.
Yep.
So yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, any sort of like standout scenes or anything that really like that stuck with you, Mary, even just because it was, you know, striking or silly or whatever, anything that you had, Derek, that we hadn't come up with yet that you wanted to shout out?
Yeah, I have a few. I mean, just a couple of spare things. I did notice that like there's a trend with Pixar movies so far that they like doing fun, funny traffic sequences where variations on traffic move is really quickly, whether it's cars or like bugs or monsters or fish.
I'm happy you brought this up, Derek, because you asked me in our last episode about, does Pixar always include future Easter eggs? So I made sure to check on that this time, and there are two Easter eggs in this movie that broadcast movies to come as opposed to reference movies that already happened.
Really?
Yes. So in Monsters, Inc., they had a bunch of Nemo references, and that movie hadn't come out yet. In this movie, there's a kid in the waiting room reading a comic book that is a Mr. Incredible comic book.
Whoa.
That movie hasn't come out yet.
Awesome.
And in the scene where the fish, I don't know if it's when they're just looking out the window or if it's when the fish are actually having escaped already from the aquarium and the dentist's office, but the street by the building, one of the cars from Cars, which wouldn't come out for another 3 years, drives by.
Wow.
So yes, they do, to answer your question, Derek.
That's so great.
Wild.
Which just illustrates how long it takes to make one of these movies.
Well, yeah. I mean, fair.
That's amazing. I like the... We didn't really talk about the sharks. Not that there's that much to talk about. They're fun. But
they're fun.
They are fun. Huge on the marketing. Not a huge part of this movie. I mean, they're delightful.
They are delightful.
But really not a huge piece of this.
Yeah. My favorite part about them actually is just that they draw multiple rows of teeth in them. Like, you never see that in sharks.
Right.
And, in movies.
That's true.
And you see all of them.
And they do it without making it horribly unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, it's just unsettling enough to be threatening and scary before you then are charmed by them at the same time. Like, it's I don't know how they manage that, but they do.
Yeah.
That is a skill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other side
of
the
spectrum. Put that on your resume.
On the other side of the spectrum is the anglerfish, which is just full on scary and threatening
the entire time.
Gosh.
I kind of forgot about the, like, deep sea sequence. And I just watched the movie Underwater with Kristen Stewart, which is like a deep sea sci-fi horror film.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like having flashbacks of that movie because you just can't see anything down there. It's terrifying. I don't like it.
And anglerfish are scary looking.
Yep.
Yes.
Very
yes.
scary fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, I think my husband would like me to point out that there is actually one legit criticism with this movie, and it is the thing that came out of it, and I went, oh my god, you're right. And that is, with actual clownfish, once Nemo's mom had died, Marlin would have changed to be female.
Oh no, really?
Yep, that is how clownfish...
I didn't know
Yeah,
that.
Real clownfish change so that there's always females around. So,
whoa.
So Marlin actually would have become female.
I fully
yep.
thought that was entirely like an amphibian and reptile thing.
Nope. There are.
I had no idea.
There are some other fish that do it. The little swordtails that we keep do it. So when our tank gets too many males or females, some of them will change to be the other. There's some others. There's a bunch of others that do it. Fish are really interesting. There are a lot of things you don't think about that actually happen in the fish world. But yeah, clownfish. And I hadn't known that when we saw the movie. We came out and I remember at some point later him going, but that's not how it works.
That would have generated so many conversations. Like if the movie had done that. Man,
yeah.
Wow.
Right. Now you're like, why did I wish they'd done that?
Right?
That would have been amazing. Right? I don't think the world was ready for that. World could barely handle Ellen at that point.
I know.
So people would have just broken down, had meltdowns seeing that.
It would have been so great.
Yeah.
People couldn't handle a background lesbian couple in Finding Dory, which came out like 4 years ago.
I know, really. So, yeah, definitely... But it would have been amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's how clownfish work.
I'm so glad we got you on for this episode, because that's the kind of stuff
Seriously.
We would have never thought about.
Nope.
All kinds of, you know, hanging out with the fishmans. My husband is actually the only one in the family that actually got into keeping fish. Although lots of people give my in-laws fish-related, you know, art and such, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that being the type of thing you either embrace or really sort of like try to distance yourself from.
No, I'm wrong. One of my husband's brothers also, though he also has lizards and snakes and all kinds of other things, but he also keeps fish sometimes too.
Sure.
So,
oh man, that just blew my mind.
Yes.
Wild.
Yeah.
That's
amazing. Go look up clownfish. They're really cool.
Wild.
So yeah, we would have had, you know, transgender, it would have been great, or I don't know how you describe it. It's not, I don't know how you, maybe that's not right.
I mean, gender fluid.
It's hard, because it's like hard, like we can only understand like our experiences and like imprint them on everything else.
Right,
you
and
know
that's,
what I mean?
And this,
so.
this is something that humans don't do, so.
Yeah. Right,
like I said, that would be the long term. But it would have.
But you could still tell incredible stories with clownfish, I am realizing.
Yes.
That would be very groundbreaking.
Right? Wouldn't that be so cool?
Huh.
Right. Love
wow.
it.
Wow.
Yeah. Somebody give me my changing clownfish, please. I want to see that.
Yeah.
Can't believe we managed to make this movie better somehow.
Right? I was like, amazing. I was determined to get this in.
I'm so glad.
Oh, hell yeah.
This is important.
I'm so glad you did.
This is important.
Yes, yes.
Good movie. Lots of cool stuff. Tons of funny jokes that we didn't even like get to because there's so much.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff in this movie. It's just fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, by the nature of how far they travel, I mean, it's just there's so much to reference. Mm-hmm. We could talk about this for probably 4 hours. So. Well, Mara, we are so happy that you joined us. We're so thankful for so many reasons because, you know, your perspective on this movie is different than one that either of us could have ever had. And we learned so much about clownfish at the last minute there that changed our lives. So thank you so much for joining us. If people want to find you or follow you, where could they do that?
I am on Twitter using my real name because I can't remember pseudonyms for myself or anybody else. I am at Mara. Greengrass on Twitter. That is the best place to find me. Or you can listen to the Toka Ladies podcast when we get around to recording another episode.
Cool. Well, if you would like to find more from us as individuals, Derek, where can people find you and the things that you are working on?
Yeah, sure. You can find me on my Twitter at Derek B. Gale. You can also find me on YouTube under my video essay series, Second Chance, which looks at bad or divisive media, but from a positive lens. What about you, Doug?
You can find me on Twitter at IckyBooley, IckyBooley. You can find me on another podcast called Victory Road, a Pokemon podcast, where my co-host Kyle and I talk about Pokemon just as we feel like it. If you are into books or movies or video games, you can also listen to me on a podcast called Novel Gaming, where my friends Vicky, Katie, and I catch up on everything that we have been consuming media-wise. If you would like more from me and Derek together, you can check out our website, wallopingwebsnappers.com, which houses everything we are working on together, including our podcast, Walloping Websnappers, where we dive into every Spider-Man cartoon ever made, and it has an archive of all of these Falling with Style episodes. We would love if you would rate and review this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, especially Apple Podcasts or Google Play, but anywhere you're able to rate, that would be super helpful. If you like what we're doing here, someone else will too. Next month, we will be returning with the next movie in the canon, which is, I'm very excited to get to this one, The Incredibles.
Oh yeah.
See you then.
See ya.
I love you too, son. Now go have an adventure.
Happy.